It's very helpful for people to hear that they should make themselves competent and dangerous and take their proper place in the world.
Competent and dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
Why dangerous?
Because it's the alternative to being weak. And weak is not good. The people who shoot up the high schools, they're weak. They're weak.
How is it good to be dangerous?
Because it makes you formidable. And life is a very difficult process. And it's not for, you're not prepared for it unless you have the capacity to be dangerous. That doesn't mean that you should be cruel. It doesn't mean any of that. There's a statement in the New Testament, the meek shall inherit the earth. But the meek isn't well translated. It means something more like, those who have swords and know how to use them but keep them sheathed will inherit the world. That's a way better way of thinking about it. You have to be powerful and formidable and then peaceful, in that order. And that's not the same as being naive and weak and harmless, which is what young men are being encouraged to be. It's like, that's a very bad idea. It's a very bad idea. Because naive, weak, and harmless means that you can't withstand the tragedies of life. You can't bear any responsibility. You'll end up bitter. And when you get bitter, then you get dangerous.
But one thing I'm not getting, there's a big difference between letting people do something for themselves and saying men should be dangerous. By dangerous, that implies I should be ready to threaten someone, to hurt somebody.
No, you should be capable of it. But that doesn't mean you should use it. There's nothing to you otherwise. Like if you're not a formidable force, there's no morality in your self-control. If you're incapable of violence, not being violent isn't a virtue. People who teach martial arts know this full well, right? If you learn a martial art, you learn to be dangerous, but simultaneously you learn to control it. Both of those come together. And the combination of that capacity for danger and the capacity for control is what brings about the virtue. Otherwise, you confuse weakness with moral virtue. I'm harmless, therefore I'm good. It's like, no, that isn't how it works. That isn't how it works at all. If you're harmless, you're just weak. And if you're weak, you're not going to be good. You can't be, because it takes strength to be good. It's very difficult to be good.
You might be say that someone who is incapable of cruelty is a higher moral being than someone who is capable of cruelty. And I would say, and this follows Jung as well, that that's incorrect, and it's dangerously incorrect, because if you are not capable of cruelty, you are absolutely a victim to anyone who is. And so part of the reason that people go watch anti-heroes and villains is because there's a part of them crying out for the incorporation of the monster within them, which is what gives them strength of character and self-respect, because it's impossible to respect yourself until you grow teeth. And if you grow teeth, then you realize that you're somewhat dangerous, or maybe somewhat seriously dangerous, and then you might be more willing to demand that you treat yourself with respect and other people do the same thing. And so that doesn't mean that being cruel is better than not being cruel. What it means is that being able to be cruel and then not being cruel is better than not being able to be cruel. Because in the first case, you're nothing but weak and naive. And in the second case, you're dangerous, but you have it under control. And you know, a lot of martial arts concentrate on exactly that as part of their philosophy of training. It's like, we're not training you to fight. We're training you to be peaceful and awake and avoid fights. But if you happen to have to get in one, and I guess the philosophy also is that if you're competent at fighting, that actually decreases the probability that you're going to have to fight, because when someone pushes you, you'll be able to respond with confidence. And with any luck, and this is certainly the case with bullies, with any luck, a reasonable show of confidence, which is very much equivalent to a show of dominance, is going to be enough to make the bully back off. And so the strength that you develop in your monstrousness is actually the best guarantee of peace. And that's partly why Jung believed that it was necessary for people to integrate their shadow. And he said that was a terrible thing for people to attempt, because the human shadow, which is all those things about yourself that you don't want to realize, reaches all the way to hell. And what he meant by that was, it's through an analysis of your own shadow that you can come to understand why other people are capable, and you as well, of the sorts of terrible atrocities that characterized, let's say, the 20th century. And without that understanding, there's no possibility of bringing it under control. When you study Nazi Germany, for example, or you study the Soviet Union, particularly under Stalin, and you're asking yourself, well, what are these perpetrators like? Forget about the victims. Let's talk about the perpetrators. The answer is, they're just like you. And if you don't know that, that just means that you don't know anything about people, including yourself. And then it also means that you have to discover why they're just like you. And believe me, that's no picnic. So that's enough to traumatize people, and that's partly why they don't do it. And it's also partly why the path to enlightenment and wisdom is seldom trod upon, because if it was all a matter of following your bliss and doing what made you happy, then everyone in the world would be a paragon of wisdom. But it's not that at all. It's a matter of facing the thing you least want to face. And everyone has that old, there's this old story in King Arthur where the knights go off to look for the Holy Grail, which is either the cup that Christ drank out of at the Last Supper, or the cup into which the blood that gushed from his side was poured when he was crucified. The stories vary, but it's basically a holy object, like the phoenix in some sense, that's a representation of transformation. So it's an ideal. And so King Arthur's knights, who sit at a round table because they're all roughly equal, go off to find the most valuable thing. And where do you look for the most valuable thing when you don't know where it is? Well, each of the knights looks at the forest surrounding the castle and enters the forest at the point that looks darkest to him. And that's a good thing to understand, because the gateway to wisdom and the gateway to the development of personality, which is exactly the same thing, is precisely through the portal that you do not want to climb through. And the reason for that's actually quite technical. This is a Jungian presupposition too, is that, well, there's a bunch of things about you that are underdeveloped, and a lot of those things are because there's things you've avoided looking at because you don't want to look at them, and there's parts of you you've avoided developing because it's hard for you to develop those parts. And so it's by virtual necessity that what you need is where you don't want to look, because that's where you've kept it. And that's why there's, you know, an idiosyncratic element of it for everyone. Your particular place of enlightenment and terror is not going to be the same as yours, except that they're both places of enlightenment and terror. So they're equivalent at one level of analysis and different at another. And this is part of the reason that I'm an admirer of Carl Jung, because Jung makes it very clear that, see, he was very interested in the barriers to enlightenment. Because if there's such a thing as being enlightened, let's say, then why isn't everyone enlightened? If it's just a matter of taking the glorious route and following your bliss, let's say, it's like, well, that sounds pretty easy. Why isn't everyone enlightened? But Jung's thinking isn't like that at all. You know, he believed that in order to transform your personality, that first of all, you had to be disciplined, that's for sure. But you also had to integrate that part of you that was terrible and capable of breaking rules and make it part of you. And so then, and I really like that idea. Well, here's an example. So about 20 years ago, I would say, there was a newspaper headline in one of Canada's major newspapers, and it was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at that time, Lloyd Axworthy, and he was talking about what had happened with Milosevic in the former Soviet Union in Yugoslavia and the atrocities that were being committed. And he said that he was caught unawares by that because he didn't have the imagination for that kind of evil. And I thought, well, you know, you think that what you're doing is signaling your virtue by making a statement like that. But from my perspective, all you're doing is stating your cowardice and your historical ignorance, because if you're going to be Minister of Foreign Affairs, you bloody well better have imagination for that kind of evil. Because if you don't, then anyone who does wins. They beat you. And so, again, in the Harry Potter stories, you see, he's touched by evil, right? He actually has a soul fragment that's embedded within him that's as black as anything can possibly be. That's why he can talk to snakes. But without that, he wouldn't be able to have any victory. And that's exactly right psychologically. Unless you can think the way that an evil person thinks, then you're defenseless against them, because they'll go places you can't imagine and then they win. And so the best men I've met, it was interesting, even when I was in junior high and high school, because most of my friends dropped out, you know, by the time they were grade 10, thereabouts. And a lot of them were guys who developed physically, they're pretty powerful, and they're just damn sick of putting up their hand to go to the bathroom. It's like, you know, they're not doing that anymore. One of my friends got kicked out when he sort of challenged the gym teacher. you know, physically. And the gym teacher, he could do an iron cross. He was a tough guy. And so it was no trivial matter for my friend to stand up to him, but he got expelled anyways. But, you know, I noticed that it was often the kids whose character I admired that either quit or got expelled. And they were the tougher guys who were just sick and tired of following rules that didn't take into account their character. And then they'd go off and work in the oil rigs or whatever. And you could do that in Alberta at that time. And that was really hard work, you know. So it wasn't like they were necessarily taking the easy path. But like, a harmless man is not a good man. A good man is a very, very dangerous man who has that under voluntary control. And you know, you also see that, like one of the central female stories, let's say, if the hero archetype is the central male story, there are variants of hero archetypes that are relevant to women, and one of them is Beauty and the Beast. And you know, Beauty isn't interested in the guy who isn't the beast. She's interested in the guy who's the beast. And that's exactly right. But she's interested in the guy who's the beast that can be civilized and disciplined, right? And who can use that in the service, well, let's say, of a family.